said of the media some weeks ago. It's the use to which we put them. And this evening I want to focus particularly upon the recreational use of drugs as opposed to maybe the medicinal use of drugs, although that is a concern for us as well. I'm not excluding that from the scope of our attention as Christians. I'm simply talking about the casual use of drugs. What should be our attitude toward them? And of course, they're all around us. We hear about drug abuse. We hear about drug trafficking. The last couple of decades have seen problems arise from drugs coming into the country and wreaking havoc in the lives of people in terms of crime and other problems that are faced. We see in our schools that children are educated at a very young age to just say no to drugs because it has quickly become recognized as a problem of epidemic proportions. I know when we first moved back from England, I noticed going by a couple of the schools these signs that said drug-free zone, and I thought, how nice. Now, that's probably some effort by the kids there to say, we're not going to be a part of drugs. But I kept seeing those signs everywhere I went and soon realized that that was really just a warning, in effect, to students that they better not be involved in that because they were going to be prosecuted for handling drugs as such. Simply saying that it's very much a problem today. Now, when we talk about drugs, recreational, casual use of drugs, what are we talking about? I am no authority on this subject. I've been reading all week trying to make myself one, haven't succeeded, but I'm going to share with you what little knowledge I have of it. I'm sure there are others in the audience that know much more about them. Let's just think for a moment about some of the kinds of drugs we're talking about. There are indeed what we call depressants. Those do not have to do with necessarily the idea that we're affecting the mood of a person, although they do that. Rather, it's talking about their effect upon the central nervous system of the body. They depress it. They slow it down, in a sense. There are such things as barbiturates or downers, such things as sedatives, different pills that people might take, sleeping pills. On the other hand, there are those drugs that do just the opposite. They stimulate the central nervous system, and so people take them as a result. Such things as cocaine, which has become sort of the drug of the 90s especially, or crack, which is a form of cocaine, which is available at a cheaper price, and such things as amphetamine, sometimes called uppers. There are hard drugs, hard in the sense that maybe more so than these other drugs, they cause physical addiction. The body, after taking these things, comes to the point where it starts craving these things and then begins to tolerate the drug, meaning that it takes a greater amount of the drug to produce the same sort of feeling. And all that time pointing the body in the direction of not wanting to withdraw that drug from it. And so if withdrawal has to be gone through, why, it's an excruciating ordeal. So physical dependence upon a drug. It's interesting, the word narcotics comes from a Greek word that means stupor. It's the idea of dulling the senses. In a sense, it's a depressant in that same respect, but a little harder drug. Such things as heroin, certainly in the 80s and the 90s, morphine used to be the drug that had the same effect. Both of them come from the opium plant. And those things are certainly problems in our society today. Marijuana use was certainly prevalent in the 60s and 70s, still is today. At one time people thought, well, there's not really anything that bad, but it's been shown that there are certainly effects that this drug has upon people, retarding their abilities in terms of mental processes and other problems that arise. Certainly in the 60s, there were such things as hallucinogens, such drugs as LSD. The idea of presenting a reality that really wasn't there, hallucinating, seeing something, having a vision, and of course, all sorts of side effects that come with that drug. Maybe not as popular today, but still a drug that people might go to if they're seeking some sort of enjoyment such as this. There are other drugs such as inhalants, especially with the young, the idea of sniffing glue and other vapors like that, introducing them and affecting the mind almost immediately. But there is also in that list ethyl alcohol, the drug that is prevalent in alcoholic beverages, and one that probably does more damage than any of the others. Statistically speaking, some 70% of the American population drinks. Today we have some 20 million alcoholics in our society. That's an increase over 3 million in 1950. Now, of course, our population has risen since that time. But that's a staggering statistic to think that 20 million Americans are alcoholics controlled by this drug and all the physical damage that it does to the body. And that's it's the third highest cause of death is from alcohol. And it's responsible for the 10th highest cause of death, suicide. And certainly when we think in terms of traffic fatalities, over half the traffic fatalities in our country, it is estimated, are caused to some degree by the influence of alcohol that has been introduced to the body through drinking beverages such as that. But we'll have to also put in this list the drug caffeine, which is in such things as tea and coffee and Coca-Colas and a lot of other things. It is a stimulant. It stimulates the central nervous system. Maybe not to the extent of these others, but it has an effect upon us. And we have to be wary of our use of such things like that. Tobacco has the drug nicotine. You might have seen recently that the FDA was considering labeling this a particular kind of drug that they might actually be able to control, which is simply to say that people are beginning to recognize, if they didn't already, that these drugs can have a very debilitating effect upon people. Now, there was a time, certainly, 30, 40 years ago, where that was not the case with cigarettes. Of course, alcoholism has been recognized for a very long time as being harmful in many ways, and yet the alcohol industry continues to market its drinks and does so legally. But we can find today that there are a lot of problems introduced by these drugs, and maybe there's a sense in which, as Christians today, we live in a society that to a large degree recognizes the harmful effects of these things. Take smoking, for instance. Take the attitude of people today in the 90s to someone who smokes as compared to 30 or 40 years ago, or even 20 years ago. It's changed radically against the smoker. And that's helpful in a sense. It produces a sort of a deterrent for someone who might consider taking up the use of that drug. To some degree, the same thing with alcoholic beverages. Certainly with drugs, as I said earlier, it's recognized the harmful effect that they can have. But for a Christian, there is a greater concern than just, say, our physical welfare or the society in which we live. Those are of concern to us, but we are concerned with our spirituality, our relationship with God, and drugs can certainly affect that relationship. Why is it then that despite all of this knowledge and the fact that people are concerned that people still persist in these problems? We have addicts of every kind across the nation. As we've already mentioned, alcoholics, people who want to give up smoking and cannot. Why is that the case? Well, let me suggest to you, just to do a very brief survey of the last 30 years or so, that there have been some reasons that drugs have had a particular appeal for people, especially for young people. Back in the 60s, it's hard to believe, but there was a sort of an ideological appeal that was pushed by some so-called intellectuals. You know, I have to think a moment sometimes when I realize that there's some people that didn't live through the 60s. I'll hear about the Beatles, and I'll have to just sit back and realize, well, some kids didn't grow up when the Beatles were around. They don't know who the Beatles are. And the 60s was an era when a lot of things were being tried. A lot of young people were rebelling against authority. Just a whole lot of things happened that even affect our society today. But one of those things was that there were so-called experts like Timothy Leary, a PhD at Harvard, who began pushing the idea that if you're really going to find truth, he had rejected, as many others, the idea that there's any objective truth at all. And, of course, one of the consequences of that is you're going to have to find it somewhere else. He said the way to find it is to take drugs and get this inner consciousness from that experimentation, and that's truth. That's what it is. And he suggested that drugs were going to be the sacraments of a new religion. And for a time, it looked like that was the case. Why, you had hippies in San Francisco experimenting with drugs such as LSD and propounding the virtues of drug use. And then in 1969, there was this gathering in Woodstock, and the organizer of that function there said that this was the beginning of a new era. It works. And that quickly came to a screeching halt. Perhaps the watershed there was 1970, when Jimi Hendrix, the rock musician, overdosed on drugs and drowned on his own vomit. And was killed, and as a result of that and other things that happened, it quickly became apparent that drugs were not the solution. And this idea of an ideological basis for drugs was renounced. Well, in the 70s and 80s, what we really went back to was what drugs had been before that time, an escape from reality. And people began using those things to escape the problems that life held for them. I think in the 90s, the biggest problem has really been, as much as anything, what we might describe as boredom. You know, if we think back, some of us my age or older or a little bit younger, we think of a time when there weren't computers, when there weren't Nintendos, things like that. What would you have done if somebody had suddenly plopped down on your lap a Game Boy or Nintendo? Why, we'd think, I'll never get tired of this. And yet we buy those things for our children today, and they'll play with them for a while, and after a while, they're just sitting there until a new game comes out. To some degree, people are just kind of bored with life, and so drugs become a way to fight that boredom. Let's experiment. Let's do something else. Indeed, when you talk to teenagers, among others, temptations are in the form of, as we've already said, escaping certain problems. It might be loneliness, isolation. Children who come home in the afternoon, parents aren't home, maybe they've only got a single parent, nothing to do. And so they want to escape that feeling, and drugs are one way to do it, or so it seems. Anxiety, pressure from school or job or whatever it might be, discouragement. There is certainly peer pressure. We might sit in an auditorium like this and say it's unwise to use drugs, but you get out of a different environment, your friends are around you, they're doing it, coaxing you on, trying to get you to do it, and suddenly the barriers are down. And there's all the encouragement in the world to just go ahead and try it once. Or it might just be the matter that we want to feel good. We want that moment of pleasure. And the only way to get that is to try this drug or that drug. And so that's one way to do it. There's, as we already said, experimentation or even boredom. Just being tired with things the way they are. The fact is that drugs take their toll. They take their toll in at least three ways. First of all, as we've already suggested, physically they take a toll. They damage the body in many ways, and I won't try and go through and chronicle all those ways. There are multitudes of statistics that show how each of the drugs that we've mentioned can do harm to the body. You think of a group of teenagers going out on the weekend for a alcoholic binge or maybe a drug binge, and think of the problems that they can cause themselves on a Friday or Saturday night. Then there is the psychological dependence that arises. Sometimes the drug itself is not addicting, but the user becomes addicted in a psychological way to the drug. As I said earlier, there are those smoking who know it's dangerous to the health. They would like to quit, but they are addicted. Now, I'm not suggesting they cannot quit, but it's very difficult to quit. There is a psychological dependence that arises because of the use of that drug. But then, as I suggested, there is a spiritual toll that we pay when we become involved in this kind of drug abuse. Over in Ecclesiastes, the third chapter, the writer there talks about a place in the heart of man that God has created. He says in verse 11, He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. Each of us have been created with a space in us that only God can fill. And when we try and fill that with something else, whether it's money, whether it's power, whether it's greed, whether it's drugs, we're not going to be ultimately satisfied. And yet the world seeks after that. Spiritually speaking, drugs are going to lead us away from God, and I would like to suggest that. And so we have to be concerned about what they can do to us. So let's think about what the Bible says about drugs. If your child were to come to you and say, Mommy or Daddy, what does the Bible say? What is to be my attitude? Is it right to take them? Is there any sense in which I can participate in this? My friends are maybe doing it. What should be my attitude? Well, again, we can't cover the entire spectrum. There are all kinds of things that we could address and say, but I want to just mention a few this evening. And I want to look at some Bible principles that would apply to the use of drugs that I think apply in both what I would call an explicit way and an implicit way. There are some statements in the Bible that we'll look at in just a moment that just say, don't do this, or be this way, and just come right out and say that. But that's not the only form that the Bible takes in teaching us how to live. There are some principles that we have to imply. They're not overtly stated as such, but when we get in a situation, we have to ask ourselves, what does God want me to do in this situation? And since the Bible was written 2,000 years ago, our society, is, in terms of its customs and traditions, is maybe very different, and the Bible doesn't describe our exact situation. But it does give us principles by which we can apply how to live and what to do in our setting today. Well, what about those explicit principles to start with? Look with me at Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20. There's an interesting word in this list of what Paul terms the works of the flesh. Let's just read from that list, starting at verse 19. Paul says, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. Here are a list of things Paul says are simply works of the flesh. Indeed, he says in earlier verses, verse 17, they're antithetical to the fruit of the Spirit. They war against the Spirit. These things are in constant conflict. One of these he mentions in verse 20 as being sorceries. The old King James, the authorized version, has witchcrafts. I'm not sure what other versions have. Now, what in the world does that have to do with drugs? Well, the word from which sorceries is translated in the Greek is the word pharmakia, from which we get our word pharmacy. When you go to the pharmacist, he dispenses drugs to you. Well, what does that have to do? How does that come out to be sorceries? Well, the fact of the matter is, when you go back into New Testament times or even Old Testament times, many times associated with witchcraft, this idea of the occult, that someone could use special powers by which to appeal to powers such as Satan, was reinforced by the use of drugs. Literally, that's what that term means. And it came to be very closely associated with someone who might be a sorcerer like Simon in Acts chapter 8. And Simon does not possess power that comes from God. How is Simon going to convince people that he does have some special power? I don't know that he used drugs, but that was certainly at the disposal of many of these kind of people. Either giving them to someone, making them think that they had some great power, maybe using them themselves. And so here in Galatians 5:20, Paul says that's a work of the flesh, the use of such things. He also includes in that list drunkenness, which was understood in those times, the idea of intoxication, an individual being unable to control his mental abilities. Now, I think there's another passage that sort of gives us an insight into this idea of sorceries. Look with me at Revelation chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. The writer here, John, describes seven trumpets. The sixth of these trumpets is directed apparently toward those who are evil. He talks about a great army of 200 million that comes and destroys a certain portion of mankind. And then notice what happens in verses 20 and 21. He says, "But the rest of mankind, who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries," there's our word, "or their sexual immorality or their thefts." Interesting that although these people had been punished in some sense, they weren't ready to give up their vices. And those vices included such things as idolatry. Now, part of this idea of the use of drugs, sometimes very closely associated with Eastern religions, which teach the idea of there being many different gods, polytheism. Here is that very idea stated, idolatry. That's what the Athenians were steeped in back there in the city of Athens, Acts chapter 17. And so sorceries have something to do with that idolatry. Notice that he also mentions they're not repenting of murders. Martin was alluding to Belfast, Northern Ireland. When we think of that place, we think of a dangerous place, don't we? We see pictures of IRA bombs having been exploded, people running in terror, lives being affected. And yet there are probably more deaths in a month in major U.S. cities from drug deals than there are in a whole year in Northern Ireland based on the terrorism there. Those are some things associated with drugs. And then notice that he talks about sexual immorality. Again, no mistake that drugs are a part of that kind of culture. They affect the inhibitions of people. They break them down. And it's much more likely that a person's willing to partake in some activity like that when their senses have been dull. And then notice thefts. What's one of the pressing problems of our society right now? It's drug addicts who need to support their habit, and so they're willing to do almost anything, break into homes in the middle of the day, in order to find something that they can trade for money and buy the next fix that they need. All of that associated with this drug culture. There are a lot of things that go with that, a lot of excess baggage that follow with it. Well, let's address just for a moment, changing gears a little bit, the idea of moderation. We know, for instance, that drunkenness is condemned, but what about using something in a moderate way? And particularly, we think of alcoholic beverages. There are those who would argue, yes, drunkenness is wrong, but what about in moderation? And to be very fair about it, I'm not suggesting that anyone who takes a drink becomes an alcoholic. That is not correct. There are people who control their use of alcohol. But when I look to the Bible, and I am concerned about doing God's will, and I want authorization from God for doing His will, and I ask myself the question, is social drinking, for instance, something in which I can involve? Where do I go to find the right to participate in that activity? Not necessarily a prohibition, but just as we sometimes raise the question in reference to instrumental music, where did God authorize it? Where did He put it in the circle that said, you can use this as a form of worship? And there are passages to which people will sometimes go. 1 Timothy 3, verse 8 lists the qualities, the qualifications of a deacon, one of which is not given to much wine. Now, the word wine in the Bible, and we can't go into this in great detail, is, in a sense, an ambiguous word, the Greek word oinos. There are times when it does suggest something that's intoxicating. Paul talks in Ephesians 5, verse 18, not being filled with wine to the point of drunkenness. It must be an alcoholic wine that he's describing there. But there are other times where that is not the case. And really, to use a generic like wine, you don't necessarily know what's being described in the passage. And I'll grant that. But what that suggests is that when we talk about the word in a biblical context, one who is going to find proof of the right to drink it and participate of something that's alcoholic is going to have to overcome that ambiguity and know for sure that a passage is giving him the right to do that thing. Now, some would say of this passage in 1 Timothy 3, verse 8, that Paul here is allowing for the moderation, the moderate use of this thing, but he's just condemning the excessive use of it. But let's just try that argument with another passage, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 17. Don't be overly wicked. There's the excessiveness of wickedness. Does that mean that a little bit of wickedness is fine? If we say, well, it's wrong to be a compulsive liar, does that make lying okay if it's just not done compulsively? We understand that in the prohibition of the excess of something, there is not necessarily authority to do it in moderation. Literally, the terminology here suggests not to be alongside of wine. No suggestion of the right to do it. Well, 1 Timothy 5:23. Someone says, here Paul gives counsel to Timothy to use a little wine for his stomach's sake. And yet, what's he talking about there? He's talking about a use for a different purpose, medicinal use. You take that for that reason. Now, again, we don't know even if this is alcoholic wine or not. There are medicinal values that grape juice has. He may be talking about that. He may be talking about something with alcoholic content, but neither of those is authorization for social drinking. Or we think of a passage like Romans 14:21. Paul describes there this idea that there are weaker brethren and stronger brethren, meaning there are some who can do a thing, others who do not feel comfortable doing it. It would violate their conscience. He says in verse 21 then, it is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. Someone says, okay, I know it might affect my brother, so therefore, even though I have the right, I'll not do it because it might affect the brother. I appreciate that concern. I think that's the principle that he's talking about there. But again, it's assuming that what he's talking about there is an alcoholic wine that one has the right to drink. We have to assume that. That's assuming the very thing to be proven. It's not the express authorization for doing it. Let's look quickly at a passage that maybe comes closer to describing our attitude towards even social drinking. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. Peter says, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in licentiousness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Now, the first sound of that sounds to me like he's just kind of rolling a bunch of things together there. But there's a distinction between the words that he uses, three of which refer to the idea of something having to do with drinking. Drunkenness, of course, is that intoxication that we've described already. The next word, revelries, has the suggestion of getting together with others in sort of a drinking atmosphere, the kind of thing people go maybe to a bar to do. And they go and just relax and unwind and have a few drinks together. Or maybe they go out on the weekend and they're just going to get bombed so that they can relax from the week that they worked. But that last word is an interesting one. The last of those three, drinking parties. Some have banquetings. And it suggests the idea of even sipping the drink itself. Suggesting not the right to be doing that, but the avoidance of that very kind of thing. And when I study the scriptures, I do not find the right or the approval that God gives one who is a Christian trying to serve God to just engage in that social kind of drinking. Maybe the punch at the office party, or the six-pack in the refrigerator. saying nothing of the industry itself and the support that we give that, if we drink in moderation. Well, what other kind of argument would there be? Somebody might say, well, you know, that's not very convincing to me. And I can well guess that there might be some who are not convinced by what I've said thus far. But I think there's some implicit arguments that reason against our use of any kind of drug in moderation, and that's another point I would make. Would we say the same of marijuana, other drugs such as that, even if they were legalized? Would we say, use it moderately, as long as you don't harm yourself? I doubt that we would make that kind of argument. Alcohol is somehow different in our minds, in the minds of some. What about implicit arguments? Let me quickly mention four different ideas here. And first of all, let me mention that when we talk about these kinds of things, we talked a moment ago about the feeling of pleasure that is derived. But indeed, that pleasure is momentary. Do you remember over in Hebrews 11:25 where Moses is said to have made the choice toward God, passing up the pleasures of sin for a season, the temporary pleasures, the footnote says. That's exactly what drugs do. They give a feeling of euphoria for a moment, for a few minutes, but one has to get another fix to get that same feeling. And as we suggested earlier, if you keep doing it long enough, that's not going to be enough. Indeed, in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4, Peter talks about the excess of riot, the flood of dissipation, suggesting that the same amount isn't going to do the same thing. You've got to get more of it to produce the same kind of high. I think it's properly termed happy hour that they have at bars and things. That's exactly right. It lasts probably for about an hour, not a lifetime. And then you're right back into the same problems that you faced before. But notice with me the idea of addiction. We've already talked about 1 Peter 4, verse 4. Look at Romans chapter 6. Listen to the principle that Paul describes there when he says, at the end of verse 6, that having been baptized into Christ, we should no longer be slaves of sin. Sin enslaves, first of all, because it condemns us. But when Christ takes away that condemnation, there is still the sense in which sin, any sin, whether it's drug abuse or otherwise, enslaves us to that thing. I don't care if you're talking about jealousy, anger, hatred, or drug abuse. Sin will enslave us. In verse 12, Paul cautions us and says, therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in its lust. Now, in light of what we've said, what little information we've said, if these things tend toward an addiction, even though we don't know for sure that we would be addicted to them, what's the safest course of action? What's the wise thing to do when presented with an opportunity to experiment with a drug? Would it not be to err on the side of caution and to avoid it altogether? Knowing that the danger that it can be, the problems that it can cause. We've all seen programs about the addicts who have a hard time overcoming their problem. Sin enslaves us. Who wants to be in bondage to any kind of drug? And the problems that it causes. That's what sin will do. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, Paul states a principle there. He says, all things are lawful. He's not saying that we can do anything we want to do. In a sense, he's saying all things that God has given us a right to do are lawful for us to do, but he says they're not all helpful. They're not all expedient. And then he goes on to say, I will not be brought under the power of anything. If something's going to control me and I can't control it, that I'm not going to participate in it. Would that not apply to the use of drugs such as we've described this evening? And I think that goes hand in hand with an emphasis that the Bible places on self-control. Over in 1 Peter 1:13, Peter says, be sober. Now, I thought that was some kind of derivative of the idea of not being intoxicated. In fact, it's the same word that means sobering up, although it's used in this passage in a metaphorical, a figurative way. But the point is, the only way that you can have a full control of your senses To be in control is to be that way. And when you start taking something into your body that's going to change the control of your faculties, you can't be in control of yourself. Peter adds in his list of virtues, 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, self-control. It's one of the fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5:23. Now I'll tell you who knows about self-control. It's the government, who has introduced laws that say if you drink a very small portion of an alcoholic beverage and get in your car and start driving it, your ability to drive the car has been impaired, and we're going to arrest you if we find out. Because you are not able to do what you would otherwise be able to do when you're not under the influence of that thing. And for Christians whose life is devoted to God and making the right decisions and the right choices, how can we put ourselves in jeopardy and introduce any kind of chemical like this that would impair our ability to make the choices that God wants us to? What about our influence? And I think our influence works both ways. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:33, evil communications corrupt good morals. And that's true if we're around that group that wants to use drugs. We've got to avoid situations like that. And someone who says, well, I'm just going to go to the bar and have an occasional drink, what situation is he putting himself in? I clipped out an article several years back. I pulled it out today. I don't have it with me, but the Denver Broncos were playing in the Super Bowl. Their tight end was Clarence Kay, and he'd been in drug rehabilitation the year before. And the week of the Super Bowl in San Diego, he caused a furor because he was found in a bar on a Wednesday. And this particular columnist said, why would he go to the bar except to engage in what you do at a bar? And he's exactly right. Why would we want to be at such a place unless it's to participate in the kind of activity going on there? It makes no sense to participate in. And if we're going to influence someone toward the right kind of life, the way we're going to do it is not by being a part of what they're doing in a place like that. And then finally, as a principle was suggested in invitation several months or weeks back, I think, what is the direction of our life? Which way are we trying to go? Paul says in Ephesians 5:16, you're to redeem the time. The idiom there from the Greek language is buy up the opportunity. It's like a market in which people are bartering, selling and trading at a fevered pitch. And you know how that is in the stock market. Why, you've got to act right now and do the right thing. Paul says you do that with your life. You redeem the time. The person that argues the Christian for recreational or casual use of drugs is saying, I'm going this way and see how close I can get to that thing that can become sinful if I'm not already engaged in the practice already. Shouldn't we be going the opposite direction, abstaining from the appearance of evil and making sure we're as far away from that thing as we can be, not how close we can get to the cliff there? We want to stay back where we know that we can do what God wants us to. Paul says in Romans 8:29, we're to be conformed to the image of His Son. And I would simply ask, can we do that, being a part of this drug culture that exists around us? If we're parents and we're trying to instill in our children, as we've been talking about this weekend, an attitude toward God, what would we counsel them about drugs? Someone says, well, you're being kind of harsh. You're just saying a Christian can't have any fun. I don't really believe we're talking about fun in the proper sense of the term this evening. We are talking about righteousness and doing what will please God and making sure in our life that we make the right decisions and we do what pleases Him. I was interested in my reading, and I'll close with this. I've gone over time. I apologize for that. But it was interesting to me that Sigmund Freud, 100 years ago, was extolling the virtues of cocaine. He had a friend who was hooked on morphine. He decided that cocaine was a good thing. He extolled it, he said, as he wrote a book in praise of that magical substance. And another doctor took him to issue, started doing some study, probably the first toxicologist that ever existed to describe the effects of that drug upon people. And he did what a lot of scientists won't do today. He made a moral judgment about that drug. This is what he said. Those who imagine they are entering the temple of happiness, this is the use of cocaine, through the gates of pleasure, are buying a moment's bliss at the cost of loss of body and soul. That's exactly what we're saying tonight. Where do our priorities lie? What's important to us? We're going to be tempted. There's an appeal that the world has, but what's our stance going to be in reference to it? I hope that God will bless us in making the right and the proper choices, that this will create a desire for further study if that's necessary, that we'll be ever vigilant in keeping ourselves holy and pure as God desires. If you're here this evening and you're not a Christian, sin has taken a hold on you. Sin reigns in your body. It may not be drug abuse, but in some way sin has a control on you, and the only way that you can break that hold is through the provision that God has made through his Son, Jesus Christ. We cannot do it on our own. Paul says as much in Romans chapter 7. Thanks be to God that we're delivered from condemnation through Jesus Christ. If you're not a Christian and you want to become one, we have an opportunity to help and assist you in that this evening. We bid you to come as we stand and sing a song of invitation.